My name is Larry Chartrand. I direct the Aboriginal Governance Program here at the University of Winnipeg, and I have this distinct honor of introducing a very distinguished panel this morning who have a strong expertise in the area of international Indigenous people's rights. How we're going to do it this morning is each speaker will have about 15 minutes to talk, and then we're going to leave about a half an hour for questions, to ensure that everybody's questions are answered and we have enough opportunity to have that kind of a dialogue. And then we'll break for lunch. Now, in terms of our first speaker, that'll be Kenneth Deere, and then we're going to have Celeste McKay, Jeff Korntassel, and Jacqueline Roman-Aubert. So I'm going to introduce our first speaker, Kenneth Deere. Kenneth has a very wide and varied career in the educational and media fields. He's a strong promoter of Indigenous media, and he also works quite tirelessly, I understand, on international Indigenous issues, and often attends the various key meetings on Indigenous issues on an international level. And so I don't want to spend too much time introducing our guest speakers because their full bios are in the program and on the website. So I want to leave more time for them to actually talk. So I do want to welcome Kenneth Deere to the University of Winnipeg. And go ahead, Kenneth.
Okay, thank you, Larry. I'd like to thank the organizers and also the traditional people, traditional owners of this land for allowing me to be here. I bring you greetings from the chiefs, the clan mothers, the men, the women, and the children of the Mohawk Nation here to you here today. When we're talking about Indigenous rights internationally, I'd like to really talk about its history and how we got there, at least from my perspective and the perspective from the people that from my area. Working internationally is nothing new to Indigenous people. We've always felt we were a people like all other peoples, and we were nations of peoples like all other nations. We had a very strong view about who we are, and we looked at our relationship with other governments like Canada at a nation-to-nation level. So working internationally is not something new or unusual for us. You know, we've many of us have had treaties with European states and European powers. You know, in our case, we've had, you know, our first treaty was really with the Dutch, the Treaty of Fort Orange, way back, I can't remember, 1635, I believe. So we knew, we always had international relations in through our history. I'd like to begin really to talk about Diskahe, a chief of the Haudenosaunee Six Nations Iroquois Confederacy from Six Nations Ontario. Six Nations have treaties with the Canadian government, particular or the British government in particular, and Six Nations always had a traditional government. And we had our traditional way of we have our own constitution, the Great Law of Peace, the Guyana Goa, which we call, our chiefs always had a nation-to-nation relationship with the Canadian government, but the Canadian government wasn't living up to its obligations, and the Haudenosaunee felt that they could not get justice in a Canadian situation, so they took their problems to the League of Nations in 1923 and 24. Diskahe, who was a Cayuga chief, went to Geneva and wanted to complain to the League of Nations that Canada was not living up to its obligations. This infuriated Canada. They absolutely went bananas, because here you had a chief of the Confederacy going to the League of Nations to speak to other nations, and Canada, which is a state, wasn't even a member of the League of Nations. Canada was even asserting its own right to self-determination. It was represented by the United Kingdom, So Canada didn't even have a voice at the League of Nations. And here you had Descahé going over there, wanting to speak with them. Of course, Canada did everything it could to stop that from happening and got the help of the League of the United Kingdom to prevent him from speaking in Geneva. And Descahé was never allowed to speak. However, he was quite a celebrity in Geneva. Geneva had its own quote-unquote Red Indian in Geneva, and he was quite the celebrity. And he had a tuxedo, had one tuxedo, which was the dress of the day, and he used to wear that all day and come back home and wash it at night so he can wear it again the next day because he only had one. The people in Six Nations used to sell their horses and cows to keep to send the money so he could live in Geneva. Anyway, he was denied speaking, and he went. but he was so popular. He was supported by Japan, Persia, and the Netherlands at the time to speak at League of Nations. But it was stopped because the Haudenosaunee was not a member of the League of Nations. They were not allowed to speak. So, but he was. People wanted to hear his speech. So the chairman closed the meeting, and the mayor of Geneva invited all of the League of Nations to the city hall to hear Descahé. So they closed the League of Nations. And as the story goes, and the delegates from the League of Nations went to the city hall where Descahé gave his speech, and it's called The Plight of the Red Man. However, Canada was so upset that Canada overthrew the government of the Haudenosaunee. The RCM, by force of arms, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police and the Department of Indian Affairs invaded Six Nations Reserve. They took all the symbols of authority of the Haudenosaunee people out of the longhouse, the wampums and documents. They took everything. They cleaned out everything out of the longhouse, and they padlocked the doors, and they held held elections under the Indian Act. This was 1924. This happened. It's not that long ago. My dad was alive, but my dad is 93. He was 11 years old when that happened. So it's not that long ago when it happened. And the message that Canada had for us is, don't go do anything internationally. We are going to punish you. We're going to punish you for doing what you did. And that's what they did. They overthrew the government. And up until this day, the situation in Six Nations and among the Haudenosaunee communities has been to resist these kind of overthrows by the government under the Indian Act. That's why today in Haudenosaunee communities, most of them, small minority of people actually vote in elections, in local elections in their community, and the authority of our traditional chiefs, the great law, still holds a lot of influence and sway inside our communities. Well, fast forward to 1973 in the United States, it was the Wounded Knee. The United States' OCA crisis. It was in 1973, and where the there was an occupation, and they were surrounded by the National Guard. There were some shootings; some people were killed. And a year after Wounded Knee, a lot of traditional leaders gathered in the United States, and they said that came to the conclusion again that you cannot get justice in the domestic situation. So we had to take our problems internationally. So they started another movement and they started along with other things that happened, a lot of other energy to try to bring our issue to the United Nations. The United Nations did not have a mechanism that dealt with indigenous peoples. They lumped us under minorities, and they considered indigenous peoples a minority issue. And it took a lot of convincing to get the United Nations to change that point of view. In 1977, there was an NGO conference in Geneva. It was called the Conference, I think, on Racial Discrimination Against the Indigenous Peoples of the Americas. And about 200 to 250 indigenous people went to Geneva in 1977. And that was a tremendous meeting, a tremendous wake-up call. The people of Geneva just were amazed to see Red Indians in the city. And the establishment in the UN was a little shook up by this because they thought this whole issue was a communist plot. to bring Indigenous people to the United States, because the chairman of the NGO conference happened to be a communist. So they thought this was a communist plot to overthrow the UN, but they were concerned about it. I was talking to some of the people who were involved in the organization, and they thought the phone lines were burning up between New York and Geneva, you know, leading up to this. And there was so much fear that there was some apprehension that the Indigenous people won't be allowed to get into the conference was inside the UN building, the Peace Palace, because they were afraid they might be blocked, they just walked through the gates en masse, and like one big lump of people just walked through the front gates and into the UN, because they were afraid that if they just wandered in one or two at a time that they'd be refused, you know. So they walked in en masse into the UN. Anyway, it was a good conference, and the whole idea was to convince United Nations that we are not minorities in the same sense, that some of us may be of a minority numbers, but the rights of Indigenous people are different. That we are different from minorities because we have a right to self-determination. Minorities don't have a right to self-determination. We have a right to self-determination. We have a right to land, territory, natural resources. You know. We have collective rights. These are things that minorities don't have, but that Indigenous people have. And the United Nations did some activities. I don't want to go into the detail. And they created the Working Group on Indigenous Populations in 1982. They called us Indigenous Populations and not Indigenous Peoples, because governments didn't want to call us peoples, because peoples in the term means rights, implies rights under international law. International law states all peoples have rights. So they didn't want to call us peoples, they called us populations. Populations don't have rights. You know, a flock of geese is a population. You know, so they call us populations, and we still have that problem. And they call us groups, tribes, bands, anything about peoples. However, the working group was the incubator for a lot of things to happen in the United Nations from 1982 onward. One of the first things they did was begin to draft a declaration on the rights of Indigenous peoples. And they worked on that for a number of years, from its origins in 82 until 1993. When the draft declaration on the rights of Indigenous peoples was passed by the Working Group on Indigenous Populations, and it had 45 articles. Principle of that Article 3 is that all Indigenous peoples have a right to self-determination. That particular article was one of the last articles to be really agreed to, and it was agreed to in 1993. In the very meeting that finalized the declaration. The declaration has all the other rights in there: rights to our language, our culture, right to our own kind of government, self-government. A whole range of rights are in there that will probably be discussed by some of our other speakers. That declaration then went up to the what's called the Subcommittee on the Promotion and Protection of Human Rights, which has been dissolved since, but they approved it without changes. And then it went to the Human Rights Commission. They came in the hands of governments. The governments grabbed the declaration and said that we don't like this declaration, we want to change it. So that ran another round of 11 years of negotiations from 1995 to 2006, where for 11 years, Indigenous people and governments butted heads to agree on this declaration, and it was a hard-fought battle. In the end, we tried hard to keep the original text intact. We couldn't do that, but we got most of it intact by the time it was passed in February of 2006. Right, it was the last working group, and then it went to the Human Rights Council because the commission was dissolved. The first meeting at the Human Rights Council, which was well described by Mr. Mayor in this morning's meeting, the first meeting of the Human Rights Council, the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People was voted on. 30 countries voted in favor of the declaration. Canada and Russia voted against the declaration. And this is Canada's... this is the new commission where there'll be no politics and human rights will take the... We're supposed to be in the forefront of the activities, but Canada voted against the declaration. And this is Canada had sponsored the working the working group on the draft declaration. For 11 years, Canada was the sponsor of the resolution resolution that carried the declaration. That at the very last minute, I think you had an election, and then they voted against the declaration, along with Russia. If Canada did not vote against the declaration, Russia wouldn't have. Canada called for the vote. The chairman asked if we had consensus. We did not have consensus. A government asked for a vote. It was Peru raised their hand, asked, well, who's calling for the vote? Then the chairman said, Canada is calling for the vote. And then they had a roll call vote after that, at that point. If Canada did not do that, Russia was not in a position to call, to be the only country to do that. And so they would not have called for a roll call vote. So if Canada did not call for a vote, the declaration would probably have passed by consensus. In the meantime, Canada has voted for a resolution at the third committee to have to reopen the discussions on a declaration. And we're in that position now where Canada is hostile to the Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous People. But that's not what I came here to talk about. The other things, though, that happened because of the working group on Indigenous populations just opened the doors to the United Nations. And it just opened up a whole, for a while, it was the only avenue that we had. It was the only it was the only working group in the entire United Nations where individuals can go up and speak and present papers, and et cetera. In all other bodies in the United Nations, you had to be a registered NGO with ECOSOC status to speak or to take part in the United Nations. The Working Group on Indigenous Populations was the exception to that. It was the only place where anybody can go up, show up, and take part. And it opened the doors, and it was a very unique situation. It was unique from 1982 all the way up, probably up until 1993, 94, up until that time when other bodies in the UN started opening their doors. The World Health Organization, when the working group asked the World Health Organization, well, what's the situation of Indigenous health in the world? The World Health Organization had nothing, no statistics, no information. So they were embarrassed, so they had to create an advisory body and do research on Indigenous health. Intellectual property rights, we wanted to protect our intellectual property, so we had to get involved in the World Intellectual Property Organization, just down the street from the UN in Geneva. So now they have a working group or a body dealing with traditional knowledge. We have the Convention on Biodiversity, has a lot of Indigenous people now involved in protecting Indigenous rights and protecting our biodiversity, our medicines and our culture, you know, in that area. There are so many other areas. So many other areas that we've now become involved in internationally, which I call the International Indigenous Movement. So there's a lot of things happening in there. It's an uphill battle. We have difficulty fighting governments that have missions and embassies all around the world. We have Canada is not always our friend. Sometimes they're our friends. Sometimes they're not. Most times they're not. We're an adversarial, particularly this time we're in an adversarial position with the government of Canada internationally, and I make no bones about it. We're in a adversarial position. It's not Canada is in a non-supportive position at this time. But anyway, I just want to give you a quick rundown of the situation internationally, and not only for the Indigenous people of Canada, but Indigenous people from around the world are in solidarity and working together in trying to raise and try to protect the rights of Indigenous people internationally. So thank you for listening, and I'll pass it on to my chairman. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Kenneth, for providing that bit of a historical overview of some of the ways that Indigenous people have tried to access justice internationally, and bringing us up to the current situation in terms of the declaration and how Indigenous peoples wish to further that important human rights instrument, notwithstanding Canada's rejection of it so far. The next speaker is Celeste McKay. She is a Bachelor of Social Work. She has a Bachelor of Social Work from the University of Manitoba. She's from Winnipeg. She's from Manitoba. She has a law degree from the University of Victoria, and is currently just about to finish her Master's of Law degree from the University of Ottawa. She has worked extensively on Aboriginal women's issues and currently does a lot of work at the international level advocating for the rights of Indigenous people. She attends many of the fora trying to address Indigenous people's issues, and in particular from the perspective of Indigenous women. So I'd like to welcome Celeste McKay up to the... Or I guess she'll be speaking from...
Good morning, everyone. Is this working? Okay, great. When looking at this topic, accessing justice at the international level for Indigenous rights, I thought we could start with looking at why. Why would we try to access our rights at the international level as opposed to the domestic level? And then I thought I'd outline some of the avenues for social justice and change through the UN system, and some examples of results that have arisen from trying to access these avenues. In terms of benefits, one benefit of utilizing the international system is that it offers a place where Indigenous peoples can go when all domestic mechanisms have failed. An example that many of you may know about is the case of Sandra Lovelace over some 30 years ago. She was a Maliseet woman from Tobik, and she could not get justice in Canada when she challenged discriminatory provisions of the Indian Act, which deprived Aboriginal women of their status when they married non-status men. So in 1977, she petitioned the United Nations Human Rights Committee. Pursuant to the communication filed in accordance with the optional protocol to the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, the committee concluded that her rights under Article 27 of the Covenant were violated. This article provides for a right to belong to one's own culture and to use one's language and community with other members of that group. Because of the provision of the Indian Act that prevented her from being a member of her community, this article was violated. As a result of the committee's conclusions, Canada repealed the discriminatory provisions of the Indian Act under Bill C-31, an act to amend the Indian Act, on June 28, 1985. Many of the discriminatory provisions were eliminated, and the meaning of status was altered, allowing for reinstatement of Aboriginal people who had been denied or lost status or band membership. We know today that there are still problems with this, and in fact, new problems were created under Bill C-31, but it's nonetheless an example of how the international arena was used to make legislative changes here in Canada. Another benefit is that the UN system offers a platform to shame Canada into remedying human rights violations that would otherwise not be revealed on the world stage, given Canada's leadership role in promoting human rights in other areas. For example, with the Sandra Lovelace case, she famously was famously quoted as saying, "We, the Native women, feel that no one should have the right to discriminate against us. I think even God would agree with me." In fact, Canada didn't agree with her and needed the UN system to provide the pressure to make the change. And we heard this morning from Ambassador Meyer about the workings of the new council and the dynamics of shaming countries in order to promote human rights. All my experiences representing the Native Women's Association of Canada has been about shaming Canada's actions and failures to promote and protect the human rights of Indigenous women and Indigenous peoples in Canada. When looking at what avenues can we specifically use to advance human rights, it's necessary to understand the way in which the UN is organized. And we heard a lot this morning about how the new Human Rights Council is organized. Basically, there are three main areas under the human rights system to enforce or advance human rights: the treaty monitoring bodies, the Human Rights Council, formerly the Commission, and other charter-based avenues, and UN specialized agencies such as the World Health Organization. When looking at the charter-based systems, I don't want to speak too much about the Human Rights Council since you just heard about how it's organized, but maybe I'd like to talk a bit about the special procedures available under the system. These special procedures include working groups like the Working Group on Indigenous Populations and the Working Group on the Draft Declaration that Kenneth just spoke about, special rapporteurs, special representatives, personal representatives, or independent experts. With mandates based on a given resolution, to entrust individuals who are independent human rights experts or groups of human rights experts. For Indigenous peoples, some of these that are of particular relevance are the Special Rapporteur on the Situation of the Human Rights and Fundamental Freedoms of Indigenous People, Rodolfo Stavenhagen, the Special Rapporteur on Contemporary Forms of Racism, Racial Discrimination, Xenophobia and Related Intolerance, the Special Rapporteur on the Right to Health, and the Special Rapporteur on Violence Against Women, its causes and consequences. These Special Rapporteurs issue annual reports as well as make country visits where they issue country-specific reports or at times issue reports on special initiatives. Special Rapporteur Stavenhagen's report on his mission to Canada from 2004 is highly useful in advancing Aboriginal rights in Canada, as he outlined his expert opinion on Canada's failure to protect the human rights of Canada. One of his overall quotes, although he covers many areas, land rights, self-determination, violence against Indigenous women, breaches of their human rights in relation to matrimonial property rights, Bill C-31, and various other issues. One of his quotes that I think is worth repeating here states that economic, social, and human indicators of well-being, quality of life, and development are consistently lower among Indigenous people than other Canadians. Poverty, infant mortality, unemployment, morbidity, suicide, criminal detention, children on welfare, women victims of abuse, child prostitution are all much higher among Aboriginal people than in any other sector of Canadian society, whereas educational attainment, health standards, housing conditions, family income, access to economic opportunity, and to social services are generally lower. These comments can be used within Canada in court cases and advocating for policy and legislative changes, but are also displayed before the world and all member states and have an impact on how Canada is viewed and is helpful over the long term in our cause to be recognized as equals. Some other mechanisms include the Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues, which is a forum that meets for 2 weeks annually in May and provides advice to all UN bodies and mechanisms, and is made up of member representatives appointed by member states and representatives appointed by Indigenous peoples of all the regions of the world. I think it's an easy forum to access for NGOs and interested people. You can simply attend and make statements and submit reports for consideration by the permanent forum. There is also world conferences. Basically, any international fora that exists, Indigenous peoples can try to access and to varying degrees of success. Like for some of the more mainstream for are less open to, or have a less open to hearing, I guess, from Indigenous peoples. For example, the Commission on the Status of Women, while there has been some work done, it wasn't until the 49th session that the first resolution on Indigenous women was ever passed. So it had met for 49 years and never specifically turned its mind to the particular discrimination facing Indigenous women. The other avenue for seeking justice is through treaty monitoring bodies of the UN. These are bodies that are designed to monitor the progress of member states in treaties that they have signed and ratified. These treaties include the committees that monitor the treaties include the Committee Against Torture, the Committee on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights, Committee on the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women, Committee on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination, the Committee on the Protection of the Rights of All Migrant Workers and Members of Their Families, the Committees on the Rights of the Child, and the Human Rights Committee. First, under all UN treaties, states that are parties to the treaties are bound to particular reporting mechanisms. For example, in the case of the International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights, states are required to report to the treaty monitoring body every 5 years about their progress in the implementation of the treaty. During this process, the particular state is required to prepare a report to which the Treaty Monitoring Committee will respond with questions for further clarification, which are then subject to discussion at the actual meeting. Often the states provide written responses to these questions in advance of the meeting. The state report is provided a year in advance of the state review meeting, which provides an opportunity for responses by NGOs, reports which are commonly referred to as shadow reports because they shadow Canada's report and outline information that maybe Canada hasn't highlighted. These shadow reports provide an important role in the monitoring of state compliance with treaty mechanisms. And further, NGOs are often asked by the committee to make submissions prior to the committee's issuance of questions. This gives NGOs an early opportunity to influence the nature of the inquiry at the committee's review and to provide accurate information on the level of state compliance. The committee then considers all the information it receives and issues concluding observations on the state's progress. These concluding observations set out the committee's assessment of the state's progress in implementing their treaty obligations and include recommendations for improving its human rights obligations. While non-binding, these recommendations are again used by civil society to effectively shame states into addressing their human rights violations. So, for example, the concluding observations of the Human Rights Committee in 2005 in relation to violence against Indigenous women state, the state parties should gather accurate statistical data throughout the country on violence against Aboriginal women, fully address the root causes of this phenomenon, including the economic and social marginalization of Aboriginal women, and ensure their effective access to the justice system. The state party should also ensure the prompt and adequate response, ensure that prompt and adequate response is provided by the police in such cases through training and regulations. So this is an example where Canada said, well, we know we have problems with violence against women, but we are funding the Native Women's Association Sisters in Spirit Initiative to address this, so we're making progress. We've got domestic violence programs. We're making progress. But nothing was said about the overall environment that creates the marginalization of Indigenous women and puts them in harm's way. So through reports by NOAC and Amnesty International and other groups where we set out the broader picture and Canada's failure to promote and protect our rights, we were able to get these comments issued. In addition to these country reports, under certain treaties, there are other mechanisms, such as under the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, there's an optional program which provides optional protocol, which provides a procedure for considering individual and or group complaints of violations on human rights contained within that particular treaty. There are two basic covenants that were established in 1966, the Covenant on Civil and Political Rights and the Covenant on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights. And unfortunately, the Covenant on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights doesn't have an optional protocol, which reflected the sharp division of the view of those rights contained in the different covenants. But now there's a growing trend to see economic, social, cultural rights and civil and political rights as interdependent, indivisible and inseparable. And there is an optional protocol underway for the Covenant on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights. I have 1 minute, so I'll try to wrap up quickly here. But to be effective, these treaty monitoring bodies must be engaged with by human rights advocates, including through human rights education and media attention. For instance, concluding observations and general comments issued by treaty monitoring bodies have been used by Indigenous peoples in Canada to show other Canadians that international human rights experts find that Canada is in violation of fundamental universal human rights. I think I'll end there now to keep within my time frame, but I look forward to discussing this more. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Celeste, for providing an overview of some of the avenues that Indigenous peoples can pursue at the international level to try to get access to justice and try to have states like Canada implement those minimum standards of human rights that Indigenous people ought to enjoy but are unable to enjoy because of Canadian policy and legislation. Our next speaker is Jeff Korntassel. Jeff is a professor from the other Aboriginal Governance Program in the country, the Indigenous Governance Program at the University of Victoria. He works a lot on governance issues and quite recently starts to get into issues of comparative critique, for example, of state apologies, truth and reconciliation efforts as the impact of Indigenous nations in Canada, Australia, Guatemala, and Peru, and is also doing a critique of or looking at the global Indigenous political mobilization during the United Nations first Indigenous decade and trying to capture some of the developments that have taken place so far in the movement to achieving a standard of Indigenous people's rights at the international level. So with that, Jeff, welcome.
Osio Doijo. My name is Jeff Korntassel from the Cherokee Nation out in Oklahoma, so I'm a long way from home, Wolf Clan. And so I guess first and foremost, I want to thank the Indigenous peoples of this territory, Cree, Anishinaabe, Métis, and Dakota, for welcoming me and our other folks onto this land. The way I view this, and we've already had a really good overview and a really good setup of some of the things that are out there and available, is I'm gonna give you some of the practical insights maybe of things that outside the UN system are happening and other forms of mobilization that might make a difference. So I'll try not to overlap too much with some of the previous speakers. The way I approach this from a Shalagi is there's a term, date esto ti, which means that which we use to help ourselves. So it's a set of tools, right, that we use to help ourselves. And kind of embedded in that are gifts that we're endowed with from the Creator. So gifts like wisdom, compassion, loyalty, intelligence. Among those gifts, though, there's a balance to be struck. And there are some things that can be overutilized. Intelligence is one of them, right? Things that can be overthought or overutilized. And at times can distance our efforts from our communities. So really what I'm talking about today is making sure that there's that balance, that community regeneration has to occur along with some of these international efforts. Has to be a balance there in terms of a rights discourse. I also wanted to say as well that, you know, even though that the panel is titled Accessing Rights at the International Level, I don't really believe that we're doing that. we're asserting our powers of self-determination, but we're not necessarily accessing rights. So it's slight difference in terms of the way I view a lot of the actions taking place globally. And as well, I think that it's a shame that a lot of these panels are separated out by issues, you know, relating to a lot of our struggles, women's rights, children's rights. As I see it, women's rights, children's rights, they're all bundled up in the same blanket, so to speak. So when we're talking about indigenous rights, we're talking about all these things. And I think that's the balance that I'm talking about. At times we get too compartmentalized for our own good. And I've seen this happen at the Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues, where we're talking about economic self-determination, but really we're talking about a lot more. We're talking about our territories. We're talking about our family relationships. So keeping that in perspective, I approach this with some optimism, but also with some criticism of, as Ken mentioned, we're in an adversarial relationship with Canada at this current point. And, you know, in my view, Canada has exhibited something that I would call polite paternalism in their treatment of Indigenous peoples. And they were recently called on that at the, this is the one forum I wanted to mention today, is the Convention on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination. Just 2 days ago, were called on not only their actions regarding other cultural groups in Canada related to the anti-terrorism bill, but also for their failure to ratify the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. So the two real motivating factors, if we're going to talk about this as a workshop, for international law as a strategy, are surveillance and shame. And Celeste has already talked a great deal about the shame aspect, the politics of shame. And surveillance is another aspect of we're watching folks, we're keeping leaders accountable, we're holding them accountable to their words. If they're talking about progressing and being at the forefront of human rights, we're also holding them accountable for those words. Because quite frankly, if this rights discourse isn't working for Indigenous peoples of Canada, then it's really not working for the rest of the folks that are affected either, in my opinion. In the words of the late Menominee Indigenous rights activist Ingrid Washinowatak, we must unlock the silence of our people, unlock the silence and let us speak to the world. She spoke these words in 1994, prior to the first UN Indigenous Decade. And I think at this point, our silence has been unlocked, so it's a question now of amplification. Where can we best amplify our voices, and where can we pursue these powers of self-determination that will make a difference, that will make the most difference for the limited number of people that we have to pursue these avenues? Keeping in mind that surveillance and shame are the primary motivators, I think there are a lot of tools, you know, that start with education. And since this is a workshop, you know, it's too bad that Victoria Tully Corpuz couldn't come, the chairperson of the UN Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues, because she would have a lot to say about this. But I do want to plug the book that she's edited with Jerry Mander called Paradigm Wars. And it's a really good primer on sort of global indigenous rights and also some of the things that we're confronting at the global level, from everything from the World Trade Organization to structural adjustment programs to some of the programs that Winona LaDuke and others are running for harvesting wild rice. So it's really a good overview if you haven't checked that out already, and it's pretty up to date. I think it came out in 2005. What's that? So Jerry Mander and Victoria Tali Karpus. And just look up Paradigm Wars, and you'd find that. Paradigm Wars? Right, Paradigm Wars. Indigenous Responses to Economic Globalization. And I think there are a lot of really good UN reports that have taken place during the first indigenous decade that are worth noting, you know, namely the Alfonso Martinez Treaty Study of 1999. I think Ken mentioned that and Celeste as well. These reports, you know, uphold treaty rights for the indigenous peoples of Turtle Island and elsewhere. They talk about treaties and other constructive arrangements. And these are useful reference points, I think, for us to look at. Madam Diaz is currently working on a report on indigenous peoples and permanent sovereignty over natural resources. And rightly, she says that before we have self-determination, we have to have permanent sovereignty over natural resources. We have to have our territory. We have to have a territorial base, a natural resource base, before we could talk about any political rights relating to self-determination. That is our governance, right? Our land is our governance. So these are just a couple of several treaties that have been, several studies that have been put out. There are also several declarations in key issue areas relating to intellectual property. And there are also some several guides from the International Work Group on Indigenous Affairs. It's based out of Denmark. Guides for accessing the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, which I think Jacqueline's going to talk about in more detail. But basically, the Organization of American States has this body that has been, I would say, at the forefront of promoting indigenous rights in several cases. The Awatsitni case in Nicaragua. More recently, the Dan case, which is really more of a report than a case, but basically found that the U.S. was in violation of international law by taking the Western Shoshone territory illegally. And, of course, the U.S. ignored it, but it's a report, and it's out there. It's part of a developing body of international law that's similar to an advisory opinion. I often ask, what would Carrie Dan do in terms of pursuing international legal options? Because Carrie and her late sister Mary Dan have pursued just about every possible option that is available, and have they achieved justice? Well, there's still a long ways from having their territory reclaimed, but they have made strides. I mentioned the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights report. More recently, they went to the Committee on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination. And the committee filed, it was a pretty unusual report, filed a very prescriptive report that the U.S. Which is a signatory to the convention, that the U.S. was to report back immediately on its violation of the land rights of the Dan family as well as the Western Shoshone. And so you begin to see the surveillance and shame, even if a country has no shame, you begin to see that surveillance and shame do kind of work hand in hand in terms of promoting accountability. Along those same lines, I think some of the most useful things to come out of these involvements in international global forums have been forging new alliances. And I think in the case of the Dan sisters, in the case of several other indigenous peoples, we found new allies by going to the working group, by going to the permanent forum. We found new allies in our struggles, and I think it's a place to compare stories, compare strategies, and it's a place to take action, much like this conference, or the much like the way I view this conference. We've already talked a lot about some of the global options. I mentioned that, you know, the Commission on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination. It's also mentioned that Rodolfo Stauffenhagen is the special rapporteur on the situation of human rights. And Rodolfo has his work cut out for him. He basically has, you know, one person for, you know, 350 million indigenous peoples around the world in 70 different countries. And he has the ability to document human rights abuses only if invited, which is, you know, another possible limitation in terms of his work. And of course, his office is underfunded and has very little in terms of staffing. So it's almost a one-person job. But he has made a difference in terms of, again, the surveillance and shame, holding states accountable for their actions vis-a-vis indigenous peoples. In one instance, he went to the U.S., and there's a community, the Tohono O'odham, that are right on the border, the U.S.-Mexico border. In fact, their people are on either side of the border. They're bisected by that, what's now going to be a fence. They're bisected by that fence. So how do these people unify as a community? How do they travel back and forth? It's been problematic. At one point, they were issued temporary visas, but now, with the rise of other vigilante groups like the Yuma Patriots, we have vigilante groups that are actually trying to patrol indigenous territories under the guise of protecting U.S. borders. It's a very strange situation. And at the same time, there are Tohono O'odham police, male police, who are assaulting Tohono O'odham women who are asserting their rights of self-determination. So it's very complicated and very much representative of some of the struggles that we have today on the world stage. So Ophelia Rivas and others who have started grassroots movements had invited Stauffenhagen, and he documented these reports. The overall impact of these reports remains to be seen, but it's documented, and perhaps other allies can come to the forefront. This is, you know, just keeping in mind, this is just one of several tools that folks can use in order to promote their community's regeneration. It's already been mentioned, the International Labor Organization does much more than just the Treaty of 169, which Canada is not a signatory. Have a lot of work in Africa and Asia, for example, in trying to promote the unity of indigenous peoples. As you may or may not know, it was the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples has been delayed in terms of ratification, and a lot has been made of the people who are the states that were delaying it. Namibia, for example, and Botswana were at the forefront of staving off any ratification vote. And the African Union recently passed a declaration saying that the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples will not be acceptable until there is a definition of indigenous peoples that fulfills more of an African vision. So a lot of barriers, and we'll talk a little bit about more of the declaration in another panel, but these are a lot of political struggles. So, you know, I'm starting to see some fractures in terms of the overall unity of the global indigenous rights movement. Other places to pursue, I guess, rights of self-determination. The World Social Forum, which often isn't thought of in that sense, but it's purely alliance building. It's coalition building. It's not really a formal program. In fact, it doesn't officially have any sort of home base. It's always rotating from place to place in terms of where it holds conferences. And I guess the last conference was in Kenya. The next one's supposed to be in 2009 at a place to be determined. But the goal is to take on the agenda of the people of that territory. So when they held it in India, Adivasis and other indigenous peoples were at the forefront of setting the agenda. So there are, you know, not that the World Social Forum is a complete model, but there are, things that can be emulated maybe from the World Social Forum. I'm running out of time here. Recently, a treaty conference was held in Obima. And as I see it, a lot of grassroots education needs to take place just on the declaration itself. If I were to pull people from the Cherokee Nation, how many of you know about the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples? I'd probably get less than 1% of our population. We have about 230,000 people. Less than 1% would even know about it, let alone who's voting for it and who's where is it in the ratification process. So we have a lot of work to do, I think, in terms of our communities as well, and that's the balance that I was speaking of earlier. For Cherokees, we started a Cherokee History Project because we need to remind our young people of our histories. And as Ken so articulately pointed out, the history of the global indigenous rights movement, we need to remind folks of those histories so that we can also see where we're going in this movement. How am I doing on time, Larry? Running out?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm out. So I guess I'll close with a story that Henrietta Mann, a Cheyenne Sundance woman, told me, just to give you some optimism. She relayed this, and I'll share this with you. At one point, the creator said, there's a lot of power to change things, and where should we put that power? And thought, well, we could put it on the highest mountain, but maybe people would find it at some point. Or we could put it at the lowest point in the ocean, but maybe people would find it at some point. Or we could put it where people will never find it and never expect to find it, where they never look. We could put a little bit in each person. So in that sense, I think there's a lot of potential for change if we find ways to mobilize across our common difference, our commonalities, and set up new innovative projects that are global. Wado, thanks.
Thank you very much, Jeff, for that overview of some of the other alternatives and strategies for pursuing justice for Indigenous people at the international level. Our last speaker, Jacqueline Roman-Aubert, is a professor here at the University of Winnipeg in the Aboriginal Governance Program. She has a strong expertise in the area of Indigenous international issues and travels quite extensively, primarily in Latin and South America, to work with Indigenous peoples on various governance issues and matters that pertain to land and recognition of their culture and governance, and also works or is involved in the OAS, the Organization of American States, and she's going to do a presentation. In fact, it's going to be a bit high-tech. She's got a PowerPoint presentation, so if we could get the technicians to lower the screen, that would be great. So welcome, Jacqueline.
Okay, now would be good. Anybody?
It's lowering.
Oh, is it? Here we go. Is it on? Okay, great. I'm going to talk a little bit today about a couple of Indigenous communities that have used the international arena in order to sort of push their rights forward. The field that I work in primarily is has to do with property rights or rights to traditional Indigenous territories. This is a bit of an outline of what I'm going to look at. I'm going to start with an introduction with the landmark case of the Awastigni that Jeff mentioned to you and why it's so important. We're going to take a look at something called a boomerang model, which explains why Indigenous groups take the incentive to go international. I'm going to bring it home with a Canadian example and talk a little bit about the Lubicon Lake Cree, take that into another model that was developed, a spiral model of human rights change, arguing that Indigenous rights are a form of human rights, and in order to sort of get broad acceptance, there's certain sort of historical processes that have taken place for human rights models, that we could sort of learn from, and ultimately try to generate an Indigenous rights norms cascade, similar to that took place with the human rights example. Okay, in 2001, there was a landmark decision by the Inter-American Court of Human Rights in the case of Awatsitigni, which is a small community of about 500 on the Atlantic coast of Nicaragua. Now, it was a landmark case because the court, found in favor of the community, and it found that the government of Nicaragua had violated international human rights law by denying the Awatsitigni community its rights to property, to judicial protection, and equal protection under the law. In the absence of formal title, the government of Nicaragua had been issuing timber concessions on Awatsitigni traditional territories, logging concessions, despite local disapproval. Now, after a lengthy battle, the court ordered Nicaragua to demarcate and legally title Awatsitigni territories. Not only Awatsitigni territories, in fact, but all Indigenous territories in the country. Now, this was a landmark decision because the court ruled that the community's right to their traditional land and territories is not something that's granted to them by the state. It's something that stems from their prior occupancy. It's also landmark in that when the court made its ruling, one of the judges specifically referred to the draft declarations as evidence of emerging sort of international customary law, that even though these declarations had not been signed, that there was sort of emerging evidence that they were going to become international standards, that they are in fact international standards with or without formalization. So that's why this decision was particularly important. Now, prior to this, Awatsitigni had been fighting for its property rights to its traditional territories for well over a decade, and they'd sort of reached a number of sort of blockages within the state. When the concession was initially granted, which was done with a Dominican-owned company called Medensa for 43,000 hectares of land, the majority which were within Awatsitigni territories, the community reacted, and they were able to, with the help of an international NGO, World Wildlife Fund, and a law school out of the United States, the University of Iowa, they were able to sort of pressure the government into signing a trilateral agreement to sort of co-manage the logging on the site. However, the government, while at the negotiating table appeared, fairly agreeable, behind the negotiating table, they were negotiating with another transnational company for another concession on another piece of Awatsitigni territory. Okay, so overall, they weren't appearing too sincere. So Awatsitigni found out about the second concession, and again, they filed complaints with the court saying, we didn't approve of this. Under Nicaraguan law, you actually have to consult with Indigenous groups before you issue concessions on their territory. But the courts really didn't pay too much attention to the complaint. It was filed again through an amparo action for emergency relief within the Nicaraguan court system. And the judge who initially heard it said, it's been over 30 days, guys, and you haven't done anything up until this point, so we took that as tacit approval. Now, the odd thing was how they were confirming that the band the community had knowledge of this concession is as proof they were taking the date from the complaint letters that they originally filed with the courts regarding the concession. So, in this sort of context, it was really hard for the community to get justice at the national level. Now, eventually, the case did make it to the Supreme Court of Nicaragua, where it was ruled that the concession was illegal. But it was rendered illegal not because it was issued without consulting with the community. Actually, it was rendered illegal on a technicality, because the government of Nicaragua had failed to get regional approval prior to the issuance of the concession. So the Supreme Court ruled illegal concession. The state pretty much ignored the Supreme Court ruling. The concession stood. And in the meantime, the regional government went back, had a meeting, and tried to get sort of after-the-fact approval of the transnational concession. So this way, Awatsitigni wasn't able to get justice at this level either. Now, Awatstigny, small community and about 500, was lucky in that they were able to get a fair bit of international attention and help. And with the American Indian Law Resource Center and the University of Arizona James E. Rogers College of Law, they were able to put together a really strong international legal challenge at the Inter-American Commission and then the Inter-American Court of Human Rights. And they won the sort of landmark case. The government of Nicaragua at the time said, oh, yeah, guys, we're going to do this. No worries, right? We support indigenous rights. And sure enough, within a year, I mean, they were ordered to pay about $80,000 in compensation and legal fees. And they handed over a check. They made a big scene. They were all over the Nicaraguan papers. You know, government, you know, complies with the Inter-American Court. But in terms of land titling, it's been it's going on 7 years since the court issued its ruling, and Awatstigny still does not have title to its territory. Okay. So we have a bit of a problem. I'm going to take a little bit at the sort of theory behind these international efforts. Now, the sort of idea is, through international organizing, is that we're going to develop new international norms for indigenous rights. Human rights norms exist. We see them, you know, almost every day, depending on what you're doing. We can see examples through the Universal Declaration and then the other covenants at the UN and other sort of international bodies. And through the draft declarations and the ILO Convention 169, we have emerging sort of norms for specifically indigenous rights. And these are being sort of pushed through transnational advocacy networks. Basically, what's happening is that, like in the example of Awatstigny, the indigenous groups really do not have access to the state. There's no access to justice. These rights exist. They're sort of recognized in international and even in state law in many cases. In the case of Nicaragua, the community had the right under the Constitution and under Nicaraguan law to be consulted prior to the concession was issued. So with domestic sort of channels blocked, there's this, I guess, where to go now, but sort of international to try to raise attention, bypassing the state and going into the international arena. Now, here I have an adaptation of something called a boomerang model that was put forth by Alison Brisk in 1993. It just gives you an idea. You've got the indigenous communities at the bottom, unable to sort of have access into the state for a number of reasons. And so instead, they go out into the international arena through the human rights or indigenous rights NGOs, and there are a number of different groups that are active in this area. There's Cultural Survival, Amnesty International have done work and things like this. There's the sort of international human rights regimes, including that at the United Nations that we've heard a lot about. There's the Inter-American system through the Inter-American Commission and the Inter-American Courts, which I think Jeff mentioned have played a really, really big role in pushing indigenous rights in the Americas. And there's been the work of the International Labor Organization through the ILO Convention 169 and other efforts. And also other nations as well. Believe it or not, there are nations that are have been historically more sympathetic to indigenous rights issues and supporting indigenous rights in the international arena. Now, the idea is sort of to go out into the international sphere, gain sort of attention, highlight your case, and they will sort of bring back and pressure the state through, you know, there's the idea of shame, surveillance, and that sort of thing. And this will access the state and cause the state to change policy in favor of the indigenous community. The main objectives, therefore, I mean, are not only specific, but also more general. We've talked about this already in terms of networking, meeting other indigenous peoples and sharing experiences, stories, and strategies, preparing and delivering speeches at the appropriate body, whether it's at the UN or the OAS. To prepare different kinds of international awareness campaigns in conjunction with NGOs. I know that Amnesty International has done a number of campaigns, for example, in indigenous rights issues, not only for Awatstigny, but for another case that I worked on in Ecuador of Sariaku. For the indigenous women in Canada, Amnesty International has put forth the campaign and things like this. And ultimately, the goal is to try to shame national governments into action. Now, in terms of Canada, a good example of this is the Lubicon Lake Cree. Now, like Awatsinya, Lubicon is a small community of about 500 that has been fighting since 1939 for formal recognition of their traditional territories. They were originally, for some reason, overlooked during the treaty-making process, and for this reason, they've never actually legally ceded any rights to their territories. And this is important under Canadian and both Canadian international law. Now, the main problem for the Lubicon is that their land is particularly rich in resources. Oil, natural gas, and timber resources, and that the province of Alberta has it in their head that this is Crown land, that this is their land, and they've been issuing concessions on this land since the mid-70s. Now, only a generation ago, the Lubicon were able to live almost entirely off the land. I mean, they were a remote northern Alberta community. This remoteness gave them some isolation and some protection from encroachment of their culture and their livelihood. So they were able to live more or less traditionally self-sustaining. But then when the 70s came and this oil development came, the environment was severely impacted and their ability to hunt and fish and this sort of thing was significantly diminished. Now, currently, there are over 1,700 oil and gas wells and countless kilometers of pipeline located within the 10,000 square kilometers of traditional Lubicon territories. Now, since the 1979, it's been estimated that this has generated about $13 billion of revenue off Lubicon territory, none of which has been seen by the community. Now, given the massive wealth that's at stake here, I guess it's not really surprising that neither the federal or provincial government have been really willing to negotiate in good faith with a small, politically insignificant Cree community in northern Alberta. Now, historically, property rights weren't an issue because of the remoteness, but as I've mentioned, you know, they've discovered oil, and suddenly it's a big deal, and everybody wants the land. Now, when the community first tried to inform the Alberta Land Registry Office that they were contesting the province's right over some of the land in question where the concessions were first issued, they were denied the right to file. They weren't even allowed to file notice. Secondly, when they went to court to try to contest the concession, while they were waiting for a date, the province introduced new legislation that basically said that you couldn't challenge Crown land. Right, so when the court date came up, their case was thrown out, saying, well, there's no ground under the new law, you have no grounding to take this case forward. Now, after this, they took they tried to impose a temporary injunction on resource development. This is in 1982 over the disputed territories. And the Alberta judge at that time refused, stating that an injunction would cause, and I quote, large and significant damages to the oil companies and to the government, while any harm done to the few individuals who hunt and trap, we could easily financially compensate later. So again, I mean, we looked at Nicaragua and thought, well, that's Nicaragua. You know, that's what they do things over here. In Canada, we're modern and developed or democratic, I guess, however we want to describe ourselves. But I mean, the situation is more or less the same. The courts are completely unsympathetic, completely hostile to these sort of claims for resources that have grounding in international law. Now, as the boomerang model suggests that I showed you earlier, the Lubicon Cree became frustrated domestically. They were getting nowhere. This was their land, their territories. It's not only that, it was their culture and their community that was being destroyed. So they decided to take their case to the United Nations. And we've heard a fair bit about the United Nations process. They took it to the UN Human Rights Committee in 1987 and again in 2005, and then to the United Nations Committee on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights in 2006. Now, in all these three instances, the UN body was entirely sympathetic to the community. And they issued, you know, warning to the Canadian government saying, you know, you should protect the territories while this dispute is in process, make sure that no more development takes place. They said that you should negotiate in good faith with the community and try to resolve this issue, and that sort of thing. And again, I mean, to this day, Lubicon does not have formal title or reserve status, we call it in Canada, to their traditional territories. The Canadian government is more or less turned a blind eye. So I guess, given this, I mean, neither the Lubicon nor Awatsinya have had their traditional lands demarcated and titled. despite favorable rulings at the international level. And so what does this really tell us? Well, I guess by trying to access justice internationally, there are other benefits. And what I'm trying to say is that it's a long process. It's not an easy process. We're just sort of really beginning. Now, it is, as the elders might say, a very long journey, and no, there are no quick solutions with or without international support. Given the structure of both the UN and the OAS, Inter-American Court regime, it has to be recognized that there are no real strong mechanisms in place for compliance. Both are fundamentally state-based systems, and if any state chooses to ignore a ruling of the Inter-American Court or the UN Human Rights Committee, there is really nothing that the system can do but issue reports and recommendations. We can do the surveillance and the shaming, but if the state is unresponsive, the state is unresponsive. Now, does this mean that this internationalization is overall ineffective? And some people I've heard tell me that it is. In terms of the Inter-American system, there have been about 10 cases that have gone forth for property rights, territorial rights. And of those 10 cases, three have been granted territory, and only because they were really attached to much larger cases that involved genocide and a lot of international shame. Here, what I've got is basically the spiral model of human rights change that was put forth in about 1998 by Rees and Sicking. And it gives you sort of the look at, well, how do you take these international norms as sort of embodied in the ILO Convention 169, the Inter-American American Draft Declaration for Indigenous Rights and the UN Draft Declaration. And the whole idea is that you need to generate pressure at the level, the domestic level in society and at the transnational level. So what's really important, the message I'm trying to get across, is that as you can see at the transnational level, there's been a lot of attention generated, but it's really important to maintain pressure domestically. So overall, internationalization, I think, has a lot of benefits, and we've talked about them. But it does not provide a quick and easy solution. You need to put your efforts at long term, generating new norms and translating those norms from the international legal level into domestic policy takes a lot of time and effort to sort of generate, to go into that spiral model and bring down from a point where states are denying indigenous rights to a point where states are actually recognizing and encoding them in law and then following up on those laws takes a lot of time. And that domestic pressure is just as important as international pressure. So there's basically a lot of work that communities need to do, not only in terms of networking internationally, but domestically as well, sort of building up linkages and using, I think, the language of human rights. Because indigenous issues are more than just poverty issues, they're more than minority issues, they are human rights issues that have been long, long neglected and overlooked. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Jacqueline, for that interesting case-by-case analysis of some of the struggles that two indigenous communities, one in South America and one in Latin America, I guess, and one in Canada, have had to struggle with. It's about, what time do we have? 11:37, so we got a few minutes. We're supposed to wrap up at 11:45, so we have actually a few minutes to have people present any questions or comments to our panelists, so feel free to do so. There's a mic in the middle there. If you don't mind going to the mic.
An article pointing out that some of the NGOs have become very interested in the situation, the circumstances of the Indigenous reserves in Canada. This was a real shock that Canada, this marvelous, wealthy country, would have NGOs coming and examining the living conditions of the native peoples in this wealthy country. The NGOs involved were totally shocked to their boots at those living conditions that they found. The housing, the education, the conditions for women, the whole total picture. Would you make some comment on that?
Yeah, I think the question is referring to a recent article in the paper, actually, about I think one of the organizations was Save the Children, an organization that has historically helped third world countries deal with these issues for the first time, is now investigating Native communities in Canada. That's the context for the question, I understand. And so are there any panelists that would like to address the question?
Okay. Well, we're not surprised that they're surprised. If you listen to Canada internationally, we live in paradise here. If you listen to the Canadian government's reports at the United Nations and international fora, Canada just tells us how many billions and billions of dollars is spent on Native people, and they say how wonderful they are and how much money they put into education and this and housing and stuff like that. But we all know that the reality on the ground is different. You know, I don't know where all that money is going. So the image that Canada has internationally is they had this altar boy image, and they cultivate that deliberately. You know, it's a deliberate cultivation. It's not an accident that the countries outside of Canada, people outside of Canada, think that it's such a great place because it's deliberate propaganda by the government of Canada. So I'm not surprised that outside NGOs would come in here and be shocked at what they find.
Celeste?
Yes, I'd agree with Kenneth. And I mean, we only have to take this morning's presentation by Ambassador Meyer to recognize how Canada conveys itself as a human rights champion. It talked about the change to require pledges from states who wanted to become members of the Human Rights Council, and its own pledge to become a member. It pledged to advance the rights of Indigenous peoples, for example, and then in the first session of the Human Rights Council, called the vote, as Kenneth mentioned, to oppose the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, which was a lost opportunity and a slap in the face, not only to us here in Canada, but everywhere globally around the world. And Indigenous peoples were absolutely shocked that Canada led the charge to oppose the declaration. The chairperson of the World Indigenous Peoples Caucus wrote a letter to Canada, you know, describing the caucus's shock and complete disappointment. And so we know that Canada has something, there's risks involved in there being an instrument that recognizes the collective rights of Indigenous peoples for Canada because of the case of the Lubicon and so many others that we know of. And because there's a vested interest to maintain the status quo, Canada has taken this this road. And it's just an example of how domestic and international violations take place by Canada.
Jeff, did you want to address that question as well?
Okay. I'll just do it real quick. Yeah, to echo what's been said, you know, Canada does good PR, and at these international forums, they have the biggest booths and the free T-shirts and all these things that champion themselves as Indigenous rights activists and promoters, and the reality is quite different. How many folks have heard of Kaseshuan? You know, the Kaseshuan Reserve, where people had to be evacuated because there was not safe drinking water, right? And there are a lot of other Kaseshawans out there that haven't reached the news. So, you know, I think Celeste may have mentioned the, you know, 500 missing Indigenous women over the last 20 years, you know, that have not been on the forefront of our discussion. So, you know, the realities are quite different, and I think they're coming to light in some ways. I've seen an innovative study or an innovative use of statistics. The Human Development Report gives sort of, you know, the rank order of the best countries in the world to live. Canada ranks 6th, I think, in 2006. But if you factor in Indigenous peoples, it goes down to, what is it, 86, something like that, or 133. So it's a very different picture if you take an Indigenous perspective on this.
Yeah, in fact, your question actually raises that as an interesting strategy in terms of getting those NGOs that traditionally work in third world countries to actually come up here and investigate the situation, and they will be shocked. I mean, the suicide rate in some of those native communities in northwestern Ontario are shocking in terms of the youth. I mean, epidemic. So there is a real concern. And yet Canada, you know, the Harper government stops the Kelowna Accord, which was supposed to provide social economic development. But that's another story. I don't want to get into that. But we have another person at the mic for questions.
As an aspiring community educator, this is something that struck me quite strongly out of Dr. Korntassel's portion of the panel. And I'm wondering how, when more and more of our youth are ending up in inner city classrooms, such as ones that are just down the street, and how do we help them strike the balance between compassion and intelligence?
An impossible question. I'll try it. We have to find ways of inspiring folks. You know, we kind of joke in our program, we call it insurgent education, sort of by any means necessary. And I think sometimes it takes, in the case of one of our students, Cheatnooks, who went to her, she saw a problem of violence against women in her community, and she took it to a march. And as a march for, and it inspired amazing amounts of people, done on a shoestring budget, done on the fly, and had a huge impact. And in fact, I would say, I'd warrant a guess that it had a much bigger impact than some of the international initiatives that we've seen, right, in terms of real community impact. I think, you know, reminding folks of their histories, you know, I don't have all the answers, so I don't pretend to. But, you know, we have to find new ways of inspiring folks. A lot of folks in the area, you know, a lot of Native youth in our area in BC are very upset for a number of reasons. The leadership they don't feel represents them in terms of band council. They see a lot of hypocrisy in terms of power, and they also see the struggle for land continuing with even the 2010 Olympics and the land grabs that are going on. So a lot of folks are frustrated, so we have, you know, channeling that into something that can make a positive change is the most difficult. And we've started movements in our neck of the woods that have had limited success, but, you know, we just keep trying and trying to reach out to folks as best we can, because I think a lot of the real education is going to go on outside the classroom, so we got to get outside that kind of classroom model. So that's just my attempt. I don't know, other folks might have ideas.
Thank you, Jeff. I think we have time for one more question, so, well, maybe two, if it's a short question, since you're lined up at the mic.
Hi. As a woman with a disability, Canada hasn't signed that convention either. Everyone else has, but Canada hasn't. So we kind of stand together. You're recognized as a nation, but we're not recognized at all. And your people with disabilities are also even worse, not recognized. It's a terrible thing. But what I'd like to know is, how do we get the media to get behind the messages that are coming from us and not from the government?
Well, that might be a question for Kenneth.
Yeah, I wish I could answer that question. I'd be a millionaire if I could do that. How can I explain it? It's one big monolith. When you have the government, you have the media, you have the institutions in this country. Discrimination against indigenous people is institutionalized. It's ingrained in the legislation. It's ingrained in policy. It's ingrained in the school system. It's ingrained in the health system. Discrimination against indigenous people is so ingrained that people can't even recognize when they're being biased or discriminatory against indigenous people. And they just can't recognize it. And they don't think our problems are as important as their problems. They don't think that violation of our rights is important as a violation of rights of others. You know, and it's very difficult to try to convince them about how discriminatory they are, because they don't believe they are. Canadians don't believe that they're racist and discriminatory. But the whole relationship between ourselves and the rest of Canadian society is based on discrimination and race. We're fighting discrimination and race, and they can't see it. So it's very difficult to get mainstream media, which is all part of that institution, all part of the educated in the same education systems as the rest of Canada, you know, cannot see it. And those, you don't see a lot of indigenous people in the mainstream media, with the exception of Carla Robertson, and there's not that many. And we're just left out, and we can't even get hard to get native columnists in newspapers, you know, in national, you know, large newspapers, because they think that we can only write about indigenous issues, but we have a mind, we have opinions on Iraq, we have opinions on Afghanistan and other things, but they don't recognize even those that we have opinions about other things other than native. We're put in a little box. That's how we are, and nothing beyond that. And I don't have an answer to you. I'm just going to say that it's part of the institutionalized racism that we face, and probably some of that discrimination that handicapped people face too.
Thank you, Kenneth. We'll just have one quick question, one more quick question, and then we'll wrap up.
Thank you for allowing me. My name is Sonia Prevost-Derbecker. I'm the executive director of Ngadinawe Mackinac Gendawad, which is an Aboriginal youth serving agency in the city. And I'm also a local school trustee. And I've got relatives in Mohawk country, in Algonquin country, and in Métis communities. So living proof that we're all related, I have a very pointed question. Kenneth, you had mentioned that Canada didn't sign the declaration. And I just wanted to know, first of all, what government was in power, just out of curiosity, and what was the justification? And one of the reasons I'm asking is I'm honored to be one of four Canadians to go to the Indigenous Working Group in Chile in March and as a delegate. And I'd just like to know a little bit of background on, you know, really what's going on here and why.
Okay, well, first of all, I'll recommend that you go to the next workshop on the declaration, and we'll have a lot more detail. But which government was in power? I presume it was the Conservatives. Not the Progressive Conservatives, but the Conservatives, which is closer to reform than Progressive Conservatism. And it's not a, you know, I guess it's not a coincidence, but the reasons that Canada gives that they have a problem with the declaration is on the articles that concern lands, territories, and natural resources, which we understand that they do have a problem with that. It's not that part we're not surprised. But what we are surprised, though, is that they also said they have problems with self-government parts of the declaration. They also have a problem with free and informed consent, which Canada says that gives Indigenous people a veto, which we don't. We disagree with that. They have a problem also with intellectual property and protection of our traditional knowledge. These are the issues that they say they have a problem with. We have, in long years of discussion with Canada, we came to an understanding about what self-government means in the Declaration. We came to an understanding of what free, prior, and informed mean, free, prior, and informed consent means, and intellectual property rights. We came to those understandings, and so we're very disappointed that Canada has changed their position on those issues. And the problem is that we just came from a meeting with a discussion with the Canadian government a week ago today when we brought up these issues, and it doesn't matter how many legal arguments that we bring up to Canada, there are other articles in the Declaration that balance any concerns that the Canadian government has are balanced with other articles. You know, there's nothing, you have to read the whole Declaration in its entirety. There's no one article that overrides, you know, everything else. The article on lands, territories, natural resources is balanced by other articles where they say when there's a conflict and how to resolve those issues. But Canada is not, can't listen to those arguments because their final argument is, well, the minister has strong opinions about this declaration. In other words, it doesn't matter how well we argue and how right our arguments are. The Minister of Indian Affairs doesn't like the article, doesn't like the declaration, and that's all there is to it. It has nothing to do with logic. You know, it has nothing, that's their position. I mean, I'm not kidding you, I'm not pulling your leg. This is the position that was explained to us a week ago today. The Minister of Indian Affairs, Prentice, does not like the declaration, and he will not agree to sign the declaration because he has these problems. And that's really where we are right now. We'll have a much deeper and more thorough discussion on the next workshop on the declaration, where Celeste will explain all this to you.
Yeah, in fact, the afternoon session is dedicated specifically to a discussion of the declaration. Celeste, did you want
to
have
I just wanted to come back to the question about the Convention on the Rights of People with Disabilities, which I'm probably getting the title wrong. But anyway, and the question about, you know, how do you move forward when you're getting excluded? And I think it really just comes back to building alliances and working at all levels. Like, we need to work at the international level, at the national level, and at the local level, and that ties back into education. And I know with Native Women's Association of Canada, with our Sisters in Spirit campaign that became an initiative on violence against Indigenous women, that was really by getting the public to understand that the magnitude of violence against Indigenous women, and getting the political will to fund the initiative. And we're a long way off, but it wasn't just because of national efforts, it was because of efforts across the country by our provincial territorial member associations too, and getting youth involved and mobilizing in any avenue that we can, and maybe that's where I'll end. Thanks.
Thank you very much. I think we better wrap it up, Jeff. So 5 minutes to get upstairs for lunch, I'm sorry, in the Rideau Hall. I'd like to thank our panelists for an extremely informative and insightful series of presentations. And I'd like to thank the audience for attending.